Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing my second memorial show to the amazing Betty Garrett. This is the second half of the interview that I did several years ago. And I'm including more songs than I did the first time around. So in this show, you'll hear a song that also features Jimmy Durante and Gene Kelly, in addition to Betty's husband, Larry Parks. And the second half of the story, more interesting stories. So hang on, here come the show. The Lynn Show is about being who we really are. It's my belief, based a lot on my experience as a psychotherapist, that all of us are hiding some of who we really are. Of course, the psychotherapeutic term for that is that we are in denial for some important parts of ourselves. By this I mean not that we are pretending, and we know this about ourselves, but we're just not showing it. All of us do that. But that we actually have forgotten that there are some significant things about ourselves. We learned early in our life that something about us, maybe some very important things about us, just didn't play well with our particular family of origin or with our teacher. Here I am remembering that my mother tells a story of when she was in elementary school, and the students were encouraged to get up and perform, and my mother got up and sang, and she had this big belt voice. And her teacher apparently didn't like that. And so she said to the class, with the obvious emphasis on how they should answer, "How many of you like that kind of singing?" And my mother essentially stopped doing that. So a really important part of her, a part of her which might have brought her terrific pleasure, got put what I call undercover, and she was ashamed to show it. So I think that this is happening to all or most of us, and that it is a shame. And the show is about recognizing that, perhaps asking yourself, what is it that I might be hiding? Then asking yourself, could I recover it? And some of the shows are talking about how we hid it, why it's important to recover, how you might go about recovering it, why it's difficult to recover. And if you're interested in any of that, you can hear a lot about that on the previous shows, which are all on my website as podcasts. And the website is thelynnshow.com. T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. S-H-O-W. Thelynnshow.com. The other thing I do in my shows is play interviews from my interview series, Anatomy of an Artist, of people who make their living or their life with an art. And today I'm playing the second half of an interview I did 3 or 4 years ago with Betty Garrett, who, in my estimation, is a person who was as much who one can be as one can be. I'm sorry how convoluted that sentence was. Betty was herself. She didn't seem to have anything much she was hiding. In addition to the extraordinary talent in every area you can imagine, Betty was seemingly without guile. You know the expression, what you see is what you get? That seems to have been written for Betty. And in Betty's case, what you saw was not only this amazing talent, but generosity, incredible generosity, kindness, availability, what Betty would have called, and I also will call, love. And as you listen to this interview, you can hear her speak over and over again about the gift her mother gave her by supporting everything that she was, letting her be who she was. And that, in my estimation, is what it's all about. Unfortunately, so few of us are able to give that gift to our kids because we didn't get it. So few of us get it. And therefore, we learn that some things about ourselves are not acceptable. But when you listen to Betty, and truly when you listen to any of the artists I interview, you hear that at least in the area of their work, they are just who they are. Because to be an artist in our culture is so difficult, and so few people have the encouraging parent who, as you will hear in Betty's case, gives up everything to support their child's chosen field. Most parents can't do that, and so most of us experience serious conflict on the way to such a career. And of course, the world, our culture, does not encourage art as a life. So in order to do it, it pretty much has to be exactly who you are. Now, we're picking up the second half of this interview with Betty when she begins to talk about what life was like after her husband, Larry Parks, decided to tell his truth to the House on Un-American Activities Committee. Something I want to say before I do this interview, because I don't want to forget to say it, is that Betty will be talking in this interview about how she finally got around to doing a production of all of the songs that she had had some part in writing over the years. This is Songwriter Out of the Closet, that she did finally collect a bunch of her friends, and they went on stage and did all these songs that she had written, some of the lyrics, some of the music, all of the song. And I was having dinner with her shortly before the show went on, and she said, So I thought to myself, I'm 88. When am I going to do this? And again, this is a highlight, a hallmark of Betty Garrett. Her courageousness, I suppose that's her courage, right? Her willingness to put herself out there. So you will hear all of that in this interview with this amazingly and terribly missed singleton of a human being. Also, I'm going to play three songs from an album that somebody made a collection of many of the recordings that Betty had been part of over her entire career. She didn't know they were doing it, and they sent it to her. And I have a copy, and if you'd like a copy, go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, and I will see you about getting you one. In any case, the first cut I'm playing from this album is the Pussycat Song with Betty Garrett and Jimmy Durante. And as in almost everything that she did, you can hear her sparkle, her comedic flair, her delight in life. And of course, you can hear it from Jimmy Durante as well. So after this cut, I'm going to play the interview with Betty. So here now, the Pussycat Song.
I'm a lonely tomcat, each night sitting here on the backyard fence.
He looks awfully cute, and I would be his girlfriend, but playing hard to get makes much more sense.
It's kind of tough on me, you see. She's such a cute little pussy cat. It's no wonder that I'm swept off my feet.
Dear little thing. When evening falls and stars appear, I wait to hear his serenade so sweet.
Come yout, come yout, my purty kitten. We will serenade the moon.
Meow, meow.
Oh, come yout, come yout, come yout, my purty kitten. We will sing a little tune.
Now, when the folks got home tonight, at 12 or thereabout, they locked the door and they forgot to put me out.
Oh, come meow, come meow, come meow, my purty kitten. Meow.
Meow. Jimmy.
Yes, my Fräulein.
What are your plans?
Oh, I thought we'd get married and find some little alley of our own. And then later on, perhaps, we could settle down on a lovely picket fence with a house all around it.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jimmy, but that's not enough. I want a large ball of yarn all my own that I can unravel all day.
Oh.
And I know you'll never be able to afford that.
Then I guess it's goodbye, kitten.
No, wait. I was only fooling. I think you're the cat's pajamas.
Too late for flattery. I have a lovely Maltese up the street who scratches her window each time I pass.
Jimmy.
Yes?
Can I come out? Come out? Come out, my pretty Jimmy. We can watch the moon above.
Nyat, nyow.
Aw, forgive. Let's live. One little kiss, please, gimme. And whisper words of love.
Nyat, nyow.
I will let you stroke my head. My hair is soft as silk.
Stay up there, cause I won't share my saucer of milk.
Can't I come out?
Yeah.
Come out?
Yeah.
Come out, my pretty Jimmy.
Coax me.
Meow.
I'm weakening. Brrr. You got me.
Meow?
Yes, meow.
Oh, Jimmy.
Meow. 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 Meow.
Okay, so then what happened with you?
Well, you mean after the blacklist?
Yeah.
Well, it was very interesting. Most people think I made a lot of pictures. I only made 7 pictures in my life.
You know, I saw Our Town last night.
Yeah, somebody told me it was on.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, that I love that. That doesn't hurt my heart at all. as I don't get any residuals from it at this point, but you know, it keeps my image up there.
Oh God, yes, and you know the you know, it's on TMC, and and then they did Singing in the Rain after it. And, but they said that Gene Kelly said that was his favorite movie that he ever made, was On the Town.
Yeah, well, he was. It was his first director's job.
Oh.
And he really had the control of it, and that was, you know, it was a groundbreaker, that show.
Boy, it sure was.
I loved it. It holds up pretty well.
Yeah, it
you
does.
Know?
It does.
But, you know, I made 5 movies at Metro, and then I'm trying to think. Well, The Blacklist started, but Larry's actual appearance started later, but it was beginning to influence our careers. And I got my sister Eileen. Mm. Larry and I we went to Europe. That's what we did. We went to England, and we would tour the provinces. We went about 3 times, and we had the most wonderful time. We put together a variety act, which we did in the United States, too. Strangely enough, we played twice in Las Vegas. There was no such thing as a blacklist in Las Vegas, which always strikes me funny. And we played there, and we did theaters. In those days, they used to have a movie, and then they'd have a vaudeville show.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie would go on again, and sometimes we would do 4 shows a night.
Wow.
Or a day, actually, would start. And so we did a series of those. We kept doing things, you know, like building a variety act, a vaudeville act, they call it here, and in Great Britain they call it variety. And we were able to take that, and we were able to play the Palladium, which was, you know, and we played all over England and Scotland.
Mm.
We never got to Ireland, but, you know, we did that over a period of years, and we stayed, and we did a lot of summer stock. Back east, the stage, was not affected by the blacklist the way the movies were. A lot of actors who were blacklisted were able to work in shows. Mm-hmm. But we did a lot of summer stock. I think we did every summer stock show that exists. And that was a lot of fun. Larry and I loved working together. Mm-hmm. It was, a lot of couples don't like it, but
it's another interesting twist.
Yeah.
Probably had the blacklist not happened, all that wouldn't have happened.
Absolutely. I realize now that I would have been stuck at Metro probably until now. And it's funny, when, I don't know whether you know this story, that I was up for Annie Get Your Gun.
No.
And Dory Sherry by that time was the head of Metro. And this was another thing that Lou advised me about. And people said, oh, you know, he ruined your career.
Because you could have gotten that.
Well, the thing was, they wanted to, actually they wanted to even cut my salary lower than I had been getting and have me sign another 7-year contract. Now, Larry had just gone through this with Columbia about the Jolson story, where they made him sign another 7-year contract. And that means they've got your life.
That's right.
For, you know, I already had 4 years left on my contract.
So there would have been another 7 in addition to the 4? Or it would have just been 7?
It would probably have started then. I can't even remember. But the point is that they had plenty of time to make money on me.
Right.
But why? That was their policy to do that. If they gave you a big plum, you had to sign another 7 years. And Lou wouldn't let me do that. And I was agreed with him, too. And I remember a conversation. Dory Sherry was a man I liked very much, and I thought he was lovely. But he said to me, he said, Betty, he said, we have people who have spent their lives here in the studio, and they're very happy. I mean, people like Spencer Tracy, and, you know, Spencer Tracy became an old drunk.
Yeah.
And and I said, I know what happens with this, Dory. I said, I signed this contract, and then a couple of years go by, and I don't have any really good pictures. Then a nice plum comes along.
Oh, no, and then you have to sign another.
And they'll make me sign another 7-year contract. And Dory said, with a straight face, said, oh, we wouldn't do that to you. I said, what do you mean you wouldn't do it to me? You're doing it to me now. But, you know, that was their, I call them the big muckamucks.
Yeah.
That was their kind of reasoning. So anyway, what happened, I had an agent at the time from the William Morris office, and he kept saying to me, you stick to it, you stick to it. They want you, so you stick to it. Don't worry. Well, the next thing I know, Betty Hutton's
got
the part, and handled by the same agent.
Oh, you're kidding.
And Betty Hutton was making a much bigger salary than I was at the time, so it's understandable why the agent would rather have Betty
10% Hutton. 10% of that than 10% of yours, right?
So, I don't know. It's one of those ironies, but I've thought about it so often. I thought, if I had signed that contract, if I had done Annie Get Your Gun, I might still be sitting at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and I'd probably be a drunk. But, you know, because all of those things that Larry and I did together,
yes.
You know, I would be stuck, you know, working, and he would be stuck doing something else. So I'm glad it worked that way. It was funny, we took a cruise, well, actually when we were going over to England to do the variety show, they showed Annie Get Your Gun on the shipboard.
Ooh.
And Larry was, you know, I think Larry wouldn't even go to see it, he was so upset. But I went to see the movie, and I came back and I told him, I said, you know, it was not very good. I'm glad I didn't do it. So anyway, that was a part of our life. Things were cut off for me for a long time, too. We had an experience one time. We were booked to do the Arthur Murray show. Mm-hmm. This was out of the blue. And we got to New York. We were so excited because this was the first sort of breakthrough that we'd had. And we got to New York and we rehearsed for a couple of days. And then one day the edict came down is we were cut from the show.
Wow.
Now, this kind of thing was always faceless.
Yes.
Nobody would say who said.
Right. Or why.
We know what happened is the big muckamucks from up there said they are not hireable.
Wow.
And I got that a couple of times, and Larry got it just blanket.
Right.
But one day, I walked into a rehearsal hall for something. I can't remember what I was doing. And Danny Thomas was there. And I had done my first movie with Danny Thomas. It was Big City at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And I loved Danny. He was a great guy. And he said to me, what are you doing? And I said, well, not much. The next thing I know, I am on Danny Thomas's variety show.
Oh.
He did a whole series of variety show before he did Go Tell Papa or whatever that show was he did. It was a wonderful series. Nothing was ever said, but I know Danny was, you know,
wow,
responsible for that, I'm sure.
Okay, so where are we now? Where Danny Thomas, we're in the 50s, the 60s? Where are we?
Well,
no, we're not in the 60s yet. Are we?
No. Well, in the 50s, it was when my kids were born. Well, of course, I'm forgetting that I had quite I figure it's on 10 years in New York. I once said, I remember it was very pompous of me to say, I think it'll take me 10 years to become a star. I can't imagine being so. But it did. I came to New York in 1936, And in 1946, I starred in Call Me Mister.
Oh, my God.
Which was, and I had done several Broadway shows before then, mm-hmm. a show called Jackpot, which didn't succeed, a show called Laughing Room Only, which was Olson and Johnson.
Ah, yes.
And what else? Oh, gosh. I did several Broadway shows, and
We have a dog visiting.
Yeah.
Hello, who are you?
This is Ruby.
Hi, Ruby.
Hi, Ruby.
That's all right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. We have...
That's enough.
We have Doggus Interrupt Us.
Hi.
So in the middle, Larry and I were married in 1944. By that time, I had developed a nightclub act. And then I brought out my act here to California to a club. And that's when Larry and I met through mutual friends. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't believe in love at first sight, but it happened.
you don't believe in
it? Yeah, well, Larry was producing a little evening of comedy at the Actors Lab. Mm-hmm. And he asked a friend of his, who also happened to be a friend of mine, if he had a good comedy sketch that he could use in the show. And the guy, whose name was Sam Locke, said, yeah, and the gal who did it on Broadway in New York is here, and I bet she'd do it for you. And so I came and did this comedy sketch at the Actors Lab, and I kept seeing this cute guy hovering around. And he asked me out for a cup of coffee one night. Mm-hmm. And he took me to Brittingham's, which was a cafeteria near Columbia, which is a big gathering place for all of the actors from Columbia Pictures. Mm-hmm. And instead of taking me into the cafeteria for coffee, he took me into the cocktail lounge and we ordered champagne.
Oh.
That should have been a sign. And then he took me up and showed me Mulholland Drive, and at one point said to me, you're the girl I'm going to marry.
Really?
And of course I laughed and I said, sure. But that was in May, and I shortly after that had an engagement in Chicago, so I had to go to Chicago, and it just happened that Larry's mother lived in Joliet, which is just a stone's throw from Chicago, so he took that opportunity
to go visit his mother.
And then he went back to California and I went back to New York, and by that time I was playing in Laughing Room Only, I think, the Olson and Johnson show. Mm-hmm. But I remember my mother saying to me once, I think you better get married, because I was getting very thin. I wasn't eating. There were a lot of long-distance calls to California. So I got on the phone the next day and said, were you serious about getting married? He said, yes, when are you coming?
Uh-huh.
And so my mother and I got on the train. In those days, you didn't fly. You took the chief and the super chief across the country. So we got married here in Hollywood, and I had 1 month of honeymoon. Then I had to go back on the road with the Olson and Johnson show. Mm-hmm. And then a year later, I was cast in Call Me Mister. Mm-hmm. And I was with that for a year. So Larry and I, the first 2 years of our marriage, we were 3,000 miles apart.
Right.
And we would grab, like, Larry would have a week here, and I'd have 2 or 3 days I could fly to California or something. Anyway, we managed. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a good way to start a marriage.
Not a lot
we
of pressure.
Fight.
No, right. No.
And so in the middle of Call Me Mister, after about a year, it was still running. It was a very big hit. Larry's mother was dying. I just felt, I had to leave Call Me Mister. That was in 1936. So, I was right. 36. That was 1946.
Yeah, right. You were right.
From 1936 to 1946.
Right.
But that was, I always thought that was pretty egotistical of me to say that.
But it can't be egotistical if it's the truth.
Yeah, right. So then I started under contract to Metro for 5 years, I guess I was under contract. And
then there was that period of time when you and Larry were doing Variety or...
Yeah.
You know.
And Summer Stock.
Right, right.
And Las Vegas and all the things. And during all of this, Lou Mandel was, I used to have a word for it. He was always hustling, you know, finding out. And he would confront Samuel Goldwyn and say, why don't you put her in this picture, you know? So, you know, you're right. It was like that sort of, I always feel like I'm sort of drifting and somebody always gives me something.
Yes.
And I'm agreeable.
It's really very like what your mother did.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And almost as though you have a kind of trust in the process, in the universe, in the... in fate, or whatever it is,
yeah.
And it comes through.
Yeah.
Which, again, I've heard this before. There's something really, it's almost, I find myself using this word also for, you know, do you know what it means to be bashert?
What?
Bashert?
No.
It's a Yiddish word,
uh-huh.
And it means meant to be.
Ah.
You know? And it's almost as though for certain people, this thing is just meant to happen. And it is going to happen, you know.
Yeah.
They attract it,
yeah.
You know, or...
And also, I mean, I give myself credit, I'm open to...
I was just going to say,
yeah.
And whatever it is, you will do
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
you know. And you can do it, whatever it is.
It's, I feel sometimes it's just plain laziness, but on the other hand, I think it's because... I don't know what it's because. It's not laziness. It's because I feel comfortable about it. I feel comfortable in going a lot of different directions.
How would that be laziness?
Well, because you feel like you didn't instigate it at all. You had nothing to do with it.
You just laid back, right.
and something took care of it, you know? But I think I'm lucky to have the quality of being able to just accept.
Yeah.
And
see, I think, you know, I think that's an interesting thing. I think that's part, a myth in our culture. That one would label that or even think or consider that as laziness.
Yeah.
Because I think it's, hi Ruby. I think it's what you said, the capacity to go with the flow, to,
yeah.
You know, to accept what's being offered. And lazy, my God, it doesn't matter. We're having another visitation from this very sweet dog. Is she a poodle?
No, she's a Bichon Frise.
Oh, yes, she's a Bichon Frise. She's so beautiful. She's just white and fluffy.
She's adorable.
She is absolutely adorable. And now she's done with us. I know how hard you work at everything you do. So, I mean, it's even up to and including that, you know, describing that at night you were learning the steps for the job you were going to have in the daytime, you know, because you just say yes to everything.
Yeah. One of the things I'm most proud of that I feel I did it, you know, I really promoted this and did it myself, was the show I just did of all my songs.
Yeah.
You know, I've been having, you know, hiding these songs in trunks and closets and things for years. And the fact that I actually got them out, gave them to people, and rehearsed them in the songs, and put it on a stage. And, you know, I don't know whether anything will ever happen from it, but I did it.
Yes.
I can't believe it.
Well, what about the book?
You mean the book of Oh, my book.
Your book.
Yeah. Now, see, that's another thing. I never thought I would write a book. As a matter of fact, the collaborator, Ron Rappaport, had a meeting with me once after seeing my first one-woman show that I did. See, now that was another thing. I was doing these little bits and pieces in workshop and you know, not thinking of doing anything with them, but just getting them off my back.
Yeah.
And people kept saying, you got to make a show of this. And John Carter, who became my director, kept, you know, bugging me, put it together. And I had no intention of doing a show, but it just kind of fell together.
It's the same thing over and over again, except, as you say, for the show that you instigated.
The one I just did.
Right, and tell the audience how old you are and were when you did this.
Well, I'm now 89, and I was 88 then, because I told the audience it was a good time to do a musical show because there are 88 keys on the piano. My son Gary told me that. But I think I'm proudest of that because I really got off my behind and did something about it, you know. But I started to say something about the fact that that almost all the things I have done have been because somebody handed them to me on a silver platter and I said, okay.
Yeah, somebody said, do this.
Yeah.
So how did the television work happen?
Well, that came, that was Lou Mendel. He went all in the family. There was a wonderful actress named Seda Thompson that was originally cast as the next door neighbor to Archie and Edith. And she was very unhappy, evidently. The first show they did, she was a theater actress,
yes.
And it just bugged her, this whole technique of television, which can be very exhausting and annoying and everything else. Norman Lear, who was a very wise man and a very kind man, instead of holding her to the contract, said, you know, please, if you're unhappy. So I think I had been up for it. I've been suggested for the part. But then when Seda left, there it was for me. And Lou Mendel had done a wonderful thing. I think this was even before Seda was cast. They wanted me to come into the office to see them. And Lou said, no, I think you and the writers should come to Betty's home.
Wow.
And, you know, that...
They don't do that.
No. But Norman Lear and the head writer, they all came and they sat in this living room and interviewed me. And that was the kind of thing that Lou did, because he wanted me to be in the position of dignity always.
Yes.
So when Seda Thompson left, then I was automatically in the show. And I was there for 3 years.
And boy, the rest is history for that.
I loved that show. Mm-hmm. It was...
Well, so did everybody else.
Yeah, and...
I mean, talk about groundbreaking and history-making. Yeah. And
Norman Lear is such a smart man and such a progressive man, which I like. But the things he did, some of the subjects he tackled, were so courageous.
Yeah.
The one that I did that I love, the writers called me one day and they said, how would you feel about if your character had breast cancer?
Oh my goodness.
And I said, listen, I'm an actress, you know, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. They said, well, some people would feel very squeamish about it. And I said, no. So they said, well, it's going to be a very funny show. They said, it's the Christmas show. I said, but what it turned out to be was very funny, but very, very meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I don't know whether you remember the scene, but it was a scene between Edith and me where Edith reveals that she's going to have to go for a test.
I do remember
this.
She's
so afraid that if she, you know, say, has to have a mastectomy or something, that Archie won't love her anymore. And I say, believe me, you know, it's not true. And I reveal the fact that I've had a mastectomy.
Yes.
And we're sitting at the kitchen table, and I say to her, don't bother to look, you won't be able to see. But there's a close-up of Edith, and her eyes, she can't help but look down. It's very funny. Mm-hmm. But it's at the same time, it was a very meaningful scene.
Oh, yeah.
And that scene has been taken out and shown in many cancer societies, mm-hmm. at luncheons and things like that, where they want to encourage
make this point.
People.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And then, of course, Laverne and Shirley came along also because somebody was playing the landlady and they weren't happy with her, and all of a sudden they were happy with me. So those things I didn't really try out for Laverne and Shirley. They just called me. The guy who one of the writers, I was doing my one woman show in Westwood, and he came to see it. And I think that's why they decided I'd be good to play the landlady. But, you know, I don't think I even went out for it at all.
Well, in a way, you didn't go out for any of it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it all came to you.
It's a
wonderful, wonderful story.
Well,
I'm just curious, Follies. When was Follies? Was, in the 90s? Was it? Was it after?
You know, I can't remember.
Boy, exactly. Neither can I, and I was there.
Because I'd done Meet Me in St. Louis, and that's where Gary met Karen.
Hmm.
And then a couple of years later, I did Follies. I'm so bad about years.
It doesn't matter. How did that happen?
Well, that happened, I was asked to audition. Now, I think that came through an agent. He's not even an agent. It's funny, there's been a guy who used to manage Lee Merriweather. That's how I first met him. Then Lee Merriweather went off and married somebody and was out of the business for a while. And Mark Levin just kind of started hanging around and hustling for me, and we've never signed a contract. That someone will answer that phone.
Yes.
And he.
So again, somebody just shows up, right?
Yeah, he was around a lot when Lee was around, and I think he got me the Meet Me in St. Louis job. Then he put me up to audition for Follies, and I met the director, who I just loved, Matthew Warchus, darling little guy from England, and I guess Matthew liked me, so...
Well, you were perfect. You know. Oh, my God, you were so perfect.
Yeah. It's funny because, see, that's another thing that is fortunate. I've seen Follies, I don't know how many times, and I've seen it, that number, done many different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And generally, it's done very brash.
Brash, you know? I know, I know.
Baby.
I know, I know, I know.
And I never saw it that way. And when we started rehearsal, Matthew Ward, just the director, just let me do it the way I felt it.
It was perfect.
And at the end of the number, I don't know whether... You remember, I just stood there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I wouldn't have had the nerve to do this. But Matthew said, don't move. Just stand there, lost in your thoughts, until someone taps you.
Yeah.
I stood there for how many, 10, 15 seconds. And I wouldn't have had nerve to do that.
But it was perfect energy.
He directed me to do that, so... it was a wonderful moment, and it's funny because I have the poster, I'll show it to you later, on my bedroom door, of me standing like that.
Wow.
And Maddy saw the show, the kids came to New York to see, my granddaughter came to see it, and she saw it, and I heard her one day showing some of her friends that picture, mm-hmm. and she said, she's in a trance. I thought that was so great, you know, that she interpreted that, I thought, just right. Mm-hmm. She's in a trance.
And she was right. She was right. It was so beautiful. Well, all right, my God, I haven't made you talk for such a long time.
Well, you know, I love to talk about myself.
Well, and it's
my favorite subject.
Well, and you are fortunate to have a really wonderful subject to talk about. So let me just ask you, if thinking about your career and making a life as a performer, if there's anything that I haven't asked you or that you'd like to say, or
Well, we were talking before about, you know, I don't feel like I devote the time to my kids that my mother was able to devote to me. However, I've sort of rationalized it this way, and I think I'm right. I've given them the gift of my independence. Mm-hmm. My mother sat in that table there, on the dinette table, all the time. And it used to break my heart because she had nothing else but me.
Yes.
And I don't think that's right. I think it was too bad that she, because she was a very intelligent, bright woman. And I think it's better for my kids to have a mother and a grandma who's active and is doing, has her own interests, so that it's not concentrated on them.
You know, I could not agree more, and also, when you do that, you give permission to the kids to follow their dream, to be themselves, not to have to worry about accommodating someone else's needs. Mm. I couldn't agree more. I think that's absolutely right.
One of the lyrics of the song that I have in my show, that the song that my son wrote the music to, mm-hmm. It's called Remember Me, and one of the lyrics is, love is not a thing to keep or to hide away. Love is not a thing asleep. It's yours to give away. So take my love and pass it on. They in turn will pass it on. That's the way I'd like you to remember me.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful, and it's, I think, the perfect way to end this interview. Thank you so much.
And neither Betty nor I could have known that would be the perfect way to remember her. The perfect way. So, there you have it, Betty Garrett, who was all about love. You could hear it in this tape. You can feel it in every performance that you saw her in or heard her in. It was love that Betty was sharing with her family, with her friends, with her audiences. She was all about giving. I say in the beginning that one of the most significant things that I remember about Betty was her incredible generosity. And perhaps that is one of the gifts her mom gave her. Her mom gave her, was generous with her, and so Betty gave us, was generous with us. If you've not seen Betty in anything, which I cannot imagine, I have on my website some videos, so you can go up on my website and see her and hear her. Again, it's thelynnshow.com. And now I'm going to play another cut from that compilation that somebody cleverly, generously, delightfully, gratefully made for us. This is another cut from the movie Take Me Out to the Ball Game. I played a cut from it last week. And if you were listening last week, you heard Betty talking about Gene Kelly, with whom she does this tune. So this is Take Me Out to the Ball Game, Gene Kelly, and the beloved Betty Garrett.
Take me
take me out with the crowd.
Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack.
I don't care if I never get back. Oh, we'll root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Mr. Kelly loves baseball games.
Why, I know all the players, I know all the names. I was raised with a baseball bat.
Well, fancy that, fancy that. You know a man named DiMaggio?
Well, I know him so well that I call him Joe.
Well, this is really great.
Uh-huh.
Listen to the band. Get your red hot tear, get your red hot
tear. Rub ramps, go good. You can't tell a player's a life without a scorecard.
Ice cold soda pop, ice cold.
Get it here. Get some peanuts.
I want some Cracker Jack.
We don't care if we never get back.
If we never get back,
we'll root, root, root for the home.
I love their uniforms, and if they don't win, it's a shame.
For it's one, two,
three strikes, you're out
at the old ball.
There you have Gene Kelly and Betty Garrett singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. One of the things I love about most of these songs is the dialogue. You have, you know, Gene Kelly and Jimmy Durante and last week Milton Berle and Betty chatting away. I love it. And as I said last week, it's reminiscent of a much more innocent time. So I'm about at the end of this show. And as always, I need to thank Josh Hackney, who has made this show possible in so many ways. As I've said over and over, he fixes the sound to the extent that it can be fixed with my limited equipment. And he tells me how to do the things I need to do, and then when I have forgotten them, he tells me how to do them again. Everyone should have a Josh Hackney. So if you have needs for help with your computer, help with electronics, or with recording, or any of those related things, Josh is the guy you want, and you can get him by going up on my website, which is still thelynshow.com. And if you go up on my website, you can see videos of Betty and various other entertaining and comedic human beings. And also you can listen to this show again if you want to. So, as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that had meaning for you. Something that interested you, told you something you didn't know, entertained you, intrigued you, captured you. I hope that this show lives up to Betty Garrett. And that it will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too. I'm going to go out on a last cut from Betty's, the compilation of Betty's songs, this one with her husband, Larry Parks. This is Side by Side, which if I'm not sounding too corny, I hope that they are now. So here, Betty Garrett and Larry Parks, side by side.
No matter what the weather,
just as long as we're together, nothing seems to matter at all.
Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money, maybe we're ragged and funny, but we'll travel along, singing a song, side by side. Don't know what's coming tomorrow, maybe it's trouble and sorrow, but we'll travel the road, sharing our load, side by side. Through all kinds of weather, what if that sky should fall?
Just as long as we're together, it doesn't matter at all.
When they've all had their quarrels and parted, we'll be the same as we started, traveling along, singing a song, side by side.
Shall we dance?
Delighted.
Oh, they ain't got a barrel of money, maybe they're ragged and funny,
but we'll travel along, singing a song, side by side.
Don't know what's coming tomorrow, maybe it's trouble and sorrow,
but we'll travel the road, sharing our load, side by side.
Through all kinds of weather, what if the sky should fall? Just as long as we're together,
it doesn't seem to matter at all. When they've all had their quarrels and parted, we'll be the same as we started, traveling along, singing a song, side by side.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may